You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk, and I'm Jose Dras Lopez. Dr. Sangeeta Swamy is an award-winning musician, a licensed psychotherapist, an educator, and a board-certified music therapist. She has worked with children, teens, and adults for over 20 years. She is a faculty member at the Duke University String School, and she has a music therapy practice called Sound Mind, as well as a private violin and viola studio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Here at WCOM, she is a fellow host. Her show is The Sound Effect on Mondays at 9 a.m., and it is online at thesoundeffect.wordpress.com. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
The first thing that I want to start off with is looking at what people's popular understanding of music therapy is, maybe correcting some misconceptions. One source of renewed attention to music therapy is the media attention surrounding Congresswoman Gaffney Giffords and how she used music therapy to help recover from her brain injury after her shooting in Tucson. But I think people still have trouble understanding how it's just different from sitting in a room and listening to some songs. It's something you could do at home. You know, why is there such thing as like a professionally trained music therapist?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people ask me that. And I think one of the main differences is that music therapy involves using music with a specific intention, using music as a form of medicine or as a form of healing. And sometimes that intention is enough to be the difference. So once when I was working with cancer patients many years ago, there was a woman who told me that singing in her choir was her therapy, period. Like that was all she was doing. But the way that she felt and the effects of the singing felt therapeutic for her. So in a very basic way, that's a basic form of music therapy. The way I use music in sessions, however, is usually more involved. And it involves what I call musical interventions, which are like exercises or musical activities that require intention and engagement on behalf of the client. Some examples of musical interventions would be songwriting, writing songs together. If somebody came in with anxiety, I would lead a guided relaxation to music, inner journeying with music, improvising music, or even discussing lyrics of songs. Those are some really simple ways that music could be used.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that people might be coping with stress or anxiety. Is that one of the more common reasons that someone might come to see a music therapist?
You know, I think that someone could come to music therapy for almost anything. Music therapists work in a really wide variety of settings. So it could be a medical setting. It could be people dealing with pain. It could be people struggling with a life-threatening illness, could be mental illness. It could be more everyday things like a family going through a divorce or a child having trouble adjusting to a new school, as well as anxiety and stress, I think, are some of the more common symptoms and experiences that people have, kind of just your everyday average person would have.
Right. I'm interested that you mentioned people might improvise music or try to write songs. And it seems like some people might be more comfortable with that at first than others. Some might think, well, I'm not that good at music or songwriting or singing or whatever. How do you work with people who are a little more uncomfortable about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And sometimes people assume that, oh, you know, do I have to be a musician to benefit from music therapy? So certainly with children, music comes more naturally. And so for most children, playing, making up songs and things like that is usually not much of an issue. However, when kids start to get around puberty and older, what we learn in mainstream society and definitely in the West and in the United States is that music is only for experts. It's only for people who have talent. And only if you have a good ear, if you're not tone deaf, can you participate in music. So in music therapy, the philosophy is very different. The profession of music therapy started in the 1950s here, but you might say that really the roots of music therapy come from more indigenous or even shamanic traditions where music has been used for centuries in many different cultures around the world as healing. And in those cultures and in those paradigms, music is a process. Music is something that anyone can do, right? There's a sort of saying that's been going around that you see on magnets and cars everywhere these days where I think it's an African proverb, if you can talk, you can sing. If you can walk, you can dance. You know, so that's the philosophy that it comes from. And it's not about making a perfect performance. It's not about playing the right notes. It's more about how you feel when you're either playing or listening to music or maybe writing words down to music. It's about the process that you go through and how it affects you.
I'm reminded, as we're contrasting between being an expert and just being able to enjoy a process, my own joy in playing karaoke games. On the PlayStation, on the Xbox, there are these games with cheap microphones where you just sing along to pop songs or whatnot. And I don't claim to be a good singer, but I have fun with my family or with friends. But I often run into roadblocks with friends who say, well, I'm not a good singer. Are you a good singer? Why do you do that? And I sort of wish we were more like some East Asian countries. Like I think Korea and China are more open with karaoke games and more willing to bear their lack of expertise and still enjoy themselves. But anyway, let's dig into what it would be like to be sitting down with you in a session. One thing would, I think I have some sense of what creating a song would be like. But one thing you mentioned we could go more into was this inner journey exercise. I didn't quite catch what that means.
Well, let me give you an example of some work that I did with a young child that I was working with. So this is a 9-year-old girl who was living with her father and stepmother, and she was showing signs of aggression. She was not listening to her parents when they would give her direction. So eventually she was removed from that home and was put in a group home so she could get some treatment. One of the things that she was experiencing was she was very anxious, obviously, to be away from her home. She was really upset about it, and she had experienced some trauma and when she was even younger than that in her life. What I did with her was, it was a sort of a combination of writing a song and doing a little bit of journeying. When she came down to meet with me, I asked her how she wanted to spend her time. And she said, well, you know, I'd really like to draw today. So I said, okay, you know, so we got out some paper. I handed her some pastels. And then I asked her if she would mind if I played some music while she drew. And the reason I did that was because for a child like that who's experienced some trauma and who's had a lot of disruption in their life, drawing is a way of kind of going into your internal world. And for some children and for adults, drawing or even just using your imagination can be really scary. And suddenly you might want to be thinking these wonderful, peaceful thoughts, but suddenly you have this image of this past trauma that happened or a scary image or a nightmare that comes into your imagination. So I started playing the music so that it would hold and contain her. And there's a very particular way that that happens. I choose the music based on the particular harmonies, based on the particular rhythms, based on the particular changes that happen in the piece of music, whether it has words or whether it's just instrumental. So the music kind of helps reduce the likelihood that those would enter into somebody's imagination while they're, let's say, either drawing or, you know, trying to come up with their own images in their head.
Can you recall which songs you chose and with this young client? You said you're trying to set the right mood and strike the right harmonies or balance that's going to help her find a safe world to draw in. I'm just curious if you recall what type of music it was.
Actually, this is a combination of many different techniques now that I'm thinking about it, because I actually improvised music for her while she was playing, while she was drawing, and I chose it based on those different characteristics that I just mentioned. I played very simple chords in a very simple harmony, and started just improvising with my voice. And it turns out she then, after she finished her drawing, I asked her to, if she would like to write a song about her drawing. And then she had been listening to the melody I'd been singing over and over again, and she had apparently memorized it, because as soon as I asked her if she'd like to write a song, she started just writing something down about her drawing. You know, it was a drawing of a sunset, and there were hills and flowers, and it was sort of this very peaceful, soothing drawing. So she wrote a song about it.
Do we have that song?
Actually, yeah. She's singing in this. It's called The Sun Is Setting, mm-hmm. and I'm playing guitar.
The sun is setting, the sun is setting. Good night, good night. Red and orange, orange and gold, gold and brown. Good night, good night. Sun is setting, the sun is setting, the sun is setting, good night. Darkening sky, fading blue, good night.
So you can see she's literally singing about the sun is setting, and you know, she's singing about the colors, and it sounds a little bit like a lullaby. Right, it's a very kind of soothing rhythm and it's got a soothing sound to it. So basically, this isn't perhaps the most in-depth inner journey that you can have. This is sort of maybe the first step where you would kind of learn to have kind of a safe inner journey. So for her, that was kind of a way of going inside herself and her own feelings into this world that was safe and beautiful, with the sunset and peaceful, where, you know, where nobody was trying to hurt her, where she could feel that kind of safety. And, you know, so she would play it at night whenever she felt scared to help her go to sleep. She always had that song with her, which is a nice thing. And since she wrote it, she, of course, had it memorized and she could sing it anywhere.
That's fun. And she's a beautiful singer, too.
Yeah.
Do you feel like she was just very confident with herself and comfortable, or that you brought her to that place?
In terms of singing?
Yeah.
Actually, no. Sometimes music lessons could be a part of a music therapy session if somebody wanted that. Again, if the intention was therapeutic. But in this case, we didn't do anything like that. That was her natural voice. And this particular session happened after many months of working together. So there was definitely a sense of trust between us. She had learned to trust me just as a person. And so I think she felt confident and comfortable recording this song. Like, she wanted to make a recording and sing it. And, you know, we tried it a few times. And there was, you know, I have some other recordings of her doing some different things, like making up songs on the piano. And I think on one of them, she's talking a little bit and she says, "Oh, I had to try this a few times and I kept messing up. But, you know, with the help of my therapist, this is what we came up with." And she's a little bit of a perfectionist, I think, if I remember this girl.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's probably what you're hearing.
Fair enough. You mentioned that the song we heard was sort of a first step in an inner journey. It wasn't necessarily really deep diving, but it was something she could take with her. I'm wondering, in general, how far children can go versus adults. I would think that there's just less capacity for introspection that would keep, like, a 9-year-old from going beyond a change in their mental landscape and their feelings and trying to analyze, so to speak, what's happened to them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with children, it's really not appropriate for them to dive into their unconscious or inner world. But on the other hand, you know, children are also closer to that world, that imaginary world, that world of creativity. They're much closer to that than we are. You know, they're just, they naturally play and heal themselves, work with themselves in this imaginary way. You know, their imaginary friends or play where, let's say, something stressful happened in their life. And then the next thing you know, you see a five-year-old child acting it out with little stuffed animals, right? Or singing a song about it. So children, in some ways, they don't need us to create some, you know, way to go deep into the unconscious in that sense. For adults, you know, we have many more barriers. We're a little more set in our ways. We're not as pliable, right? And yeah. So we need a little bit stronger methods to, I think, to penetrate some of those barriers and to look deeper within to see what might be causing problems or creating obstacles in our life.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about some of the barriers adults put up. But my first thought about adults is that they probably are more picky about music. Like they've had more time to develop very particular tastes. And I'm wondering how you get to know adult clients on that level and figure out that they actually really love loud rap or they don't like guitars so much or who knows what.
Yeah, music, you know, music is really connected to identity. Generally, you know, people have definite preferences, some stronger than others. So usually, if you're working with somebody who's conscious, who's not, let's say, in a coma or something, then obviously you can, we talk about it. You know, it's a collaborative process. The way that I do music therapy, it's a collaboration. I am not going to come in with some prescription and say, you need to listen to ABC, you know, pieces of music five times a day. And that's not going to work. I haven't found that to be effective. So it's really important to find out what people's musical preferences are. And basically, I just ask. It's one of the first things that we do in addition to asking people about, you know, why are they coming? What are their symptoms? What are the obstacles they want to overcome? You know, I ask them, what's their experience with music? What are their musical preferences? Is there any kind of music that they really hate or have negative associations with? And why? Was there any particular connection, you know, event or something that led to that? Mm-hmm. And people will usually say, if they hate certain kinds of music, they'll definitely tell you. Or if they forget to and you start playing something and say, oh, let's relax, you know, to this piece. And then they'll say, oh, my God, I hate that kind of new age elevator music. And
oh, what can you do? Well, you just put on a different song, right?
Yeah. So we talk about it. And sometimes it's worth it to have a discussion about why that is. But usually I think what I do as a music therapist that's different from maybe other forms of, let's say, sound healing or other forms of therapy that might use music is that I start with music that clients are comfortable or familiar with in order to develop this trusting and working alliance together. Because there might be a point where let's say there's a client who comes in who's, you know, 18 and kind of working on leaving the house or going to college and is living with their parents and is having a lot of conflict. And especially teenagers have a lot of a really strong identification with the music that they listen to. It really can define who they are in their peer group. So, you know, initially we might just listen to some songs together. I might ask clients to bring in, what are some of their favorite pieces of music? You know, bring it in and let's talk about it. Well, you know, what's so meaningful about that piece for you? And often there's a story behind it, and it helps me get a sense of who they are, how they work, what's important to them, and what their needs are, and how I can better help serve them. So we might, let's say somebody comes in and they, you know, they love the oldies, or they love, let's say, current hip hop and rap and rock music. So we might just listen to those songs together. Then, you know, they might have, I don't know, maybe they have a parent who loves oldies music like 70s, Beatles, Grateful Dead, something like that, but they hate it. So it's not just that they hate it because, well, they just don't like it. It has a particular meaning that maybe is related to exactly what they're coming into therapy for. They're trying to figure out how to be on their own, how to maybe get a job, get out of the house, and maybe their relationship with one of their parents is really negative and stressful and causing a lot of problems for them. So then we might, at some point when we've sort of built up that trusting relationship, then we might talk about that Grateful Dead music or listen to some of it. So that would sort of create a little bit more of a challenge that might give them an opportunity to then talk about their relationship with one of those parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that people attach stories to songs, as you were saying. And I think it's usually a story associated with a particular song by a particular artist. Like, oh, this is a song that makes me think of my ex-boyfriend. But I'm wondering how you see music eliciting different sorts of stories and conflicts out of people. Can it just be like a fast song makes them think of something scary that's happened to them recently, or some sense of what it's like for a person to move from sound to, oh, this is what's happening in my life, or this is what happened that I'm linking this song to? What does that sound like?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different theories and research about this idea, about how does music really work, right? So there's some people who say that all music is what they call referential. All music has associations, and the meanings and the reasons that we like it are only based on the associations that we have with it, times, you know, of our life, we listen to it, etc. Then there are other people who say, oh, well, you know, but we have research saying that no, music, it's just based on the acoustic qualities, like you mentioned, like how fast or slow or loud it is. And that's what stimulates, you know, people's reaction to it, emotional or physical or whatever. You know, and there's also research, Oliver Sacks is doing a lot of research these days about this very idea. And he was on a special on Nova where they hooked his brain up to a MRI or a PET scan or something like that, where he listened to, you know, one of his favorite composers. And so when he listened to it, like it showed up, it was lighting up all different areas of his brain. You know, it was engaging all of these different areas of emotion and language and motor skills and things like that. And then when they put on something that was sort of okay, like Beethoven, wasn't his absolute favorite, you know, the areas of his brain that it stimulated, it was much smaller. You know, there's a lot more research coming out about how music works. And I think there are many right answers. I think there's not just one. I think there's not just one. And there is a lot of research to support these different angles. So, you know, my basic approach is that there's truth in all of them.
Yeah, I can see that. I couldn't see how it would be just referential or just acoustic. It seems like whatever different lines of research there are, the truth is probably some convergence of them. Well, I'm wondering if there's any music that's just off the table, unless your client brings it in and says, this is a very meaningful song to me. If they're just, you're not going to play dubstep, you know, you're not going to play, you know, just like really like grinding electronic dubstep music. Like that's not something you're ever going to play unless the person just really likes it. Is there anything like that for you that's just a little Rubicon that you're personally not that interested in it?
Well, actually, my job as a music therapist is to serve the needs of the people in front of me, serve the needs of the clients. So I have to put all of my own musical preferences to the side and not let that influence what kind of music or what choices that I would necessarily make in terms of musical genres towards a client. So my job is to use music that is going to be most helpful to them. And most of the time, it depends on who I'm working with. Well, I'll say a lot of the time in the past, I have not used music that is my favorite music. And sure, absolutely, people have brought in music that I don't particularly like. I'm not particularly fond of Lil Wayne. And I've heard a lot of that in sessions of teenagers. You know, because I don't know if he still is, but he was popular for a while. And
what about Justin Bieber? Are you a believer?
You know, I haven't had anybody bring in any Justin Bieber. Yeah.
In due time.
Yes.
Someone will bring
it. Absolutely. So, you know, but the thing is, I think to be a music therapist, you have to appreciate many different types of music. If you just really can't get over and you can't tolerate certain types of music, you either have to not work with populations that, you know, particularly like that music, or you have to figure out a way to be able to relate to it in some way. And I have to say, my clients have really taught me a lot of new music. There's some I can honestly say that before I started working as a music therapist that I never listened to hip hop and rap.
Well, how long has it been since you first started?
I think with my training, it's been about 13 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So coming into it, you'd never listened to hip hop and rap. That was actually sort of my next question. Like, how much has your musical awareness and how much of your preferences changed in the time that you've been doing music therapy?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily that my preferences have changed. I still like to listen to the music that I like to listen to. But, you know, on my iPod, I have a really wide range of music and I've come to appreciate a lot of it. So I may not choose in my free time to listen to it, some of my clients' music, but a lot of it that they've brought into me, I've been pleasantly surprised to find that is good music. You know, they're good melodies and meaningful messages, even if there's many swear words thrown in in between. You know, and it really gives me a sense. I mean, some of that music, again, I always look at it therapeutically, and I always look at it, well, what does this piece tell me about? What does this song tell me about this person? And so if somebody brings in, you know, 50 Cent Candy Shop, which is has very inappropriate topics for teens and kids and a lot of sexually explicit references. You know, that tells me a lot about that client right away. If they can relate to certain lyrics, or it might tell me about their attitudes about sexuality. It might tell me about their attitudes around violence. So I sort of listen for those things, rather than whether, you know, I don't really pay attention to how much I like it so much.
That makes sense. And again, that's sort of the difference between just sitting in a room listening to music and music therapy with a trained therapist. We got to this question of different types and genres of music through moving from children to teenagers and adults. And teenagers maybe strongly identify with certain songs. Adults will have over time found certain songs to be, or certain genres to be more important to them, more interesting. Another issue with adults, as you mentioned, is that they have more barriers. And so maybe you need to try more different angles or more aggressive approaches. So tell us what a music therapist can do to try to help people become more disinhibited or more open with themselves. And maybe even how you can combine music therapy with other modalities. You already started to talk about that with the example you gave with your client, where there was art involved, right?
Mm.
So there's more of that can happen when you're combining with art or literature or something else. What are the different tools you have on your music therapist utility belt?
So it really depends on the type, the condition, and the symptoms that somebody's coming in with. So if somebody, for instance, came in with, we talked about anxiety earlier, that's one of the things I see a lot and that I've done some work with. One of the things that's wonderful about music is that it has a natural ability to bypass the conscious mind. And so in some ways, I don't have to do a lot of extra work to push through barriers. And in some ways, perhaps when I said that earlier, that wasn't really accurate in that we have barriers for reasons. They're there for reasons. We don't want to be walking around with just an open door to every part of our life that anybody could access or, you know, see or talk to. Or we don't want our memories and our feelings to just be easily accessible to just strangers and things like that. So there's a reason those barriers are there. So I think it really is important to respect that. And, you know, I like to take, especially adults, to take small steps. towards those goals. So let's say with anxiety, let's say somebody was particularly, had particular anxiety about driving, right? For some reason, maybe they were in a car accident several years ago, and ever since then, every time they get on this particular part of the highway, every time it rains, or, you know, there's certain kind of triggers that trigger this memory in the brain, and suddenly they start sweating, they start gripping the wheel, their heart starts beating, they're having all these symptoms, and they're, you know, it's interfering with their life. They're not able to drive as many places as they wanted to. So we would start one step at a time. So we might find a piece of music that they felt was relaxing to them, and simply practice really basic muscle relaxation exercises to that music in the office. So it might be just like putting on the music, and, you know, it might be like some really simple exercises, or like, you know, how you flex and different parts of your body. Let's say you flex your hands and you breathe in and you count to three and then you breathe out and you let go, you release all your muscles. And so the music really helps to slow down the physiology of the body and slow down the heartbeat if it's, you know, if you've got an appropriate choice of music that's, let's say, has a nice slow beat to it.
Mm-hmm.
So we might just start with that and make a CD, have this person practice it, you know, every day for a week. Then we might introduce something, the next step. Let's say, okay, now that that's become more natural, automatic, let's now think of getting in your car. Not driving it yet, but we'll just take a small step. Let's just think about getting in your car. Okay, how does that make you feel? Well, they might say, well, not terrible, but, you know, I can sort of feel my, you know, my fists start to tighten a little bit. So we might start with that image and then do the relaxation. We might have them practice that at home, going to approach their car and then practicing their relaxation. So like that, you know, I think working with these barriers will go one step at a time. Then it would be getting in the car. Then it would be driving on a sunny day. Then it would be driving, you know, on that maybe particular highway. And then, you know, until we finally sort of reach that place. So that could take, you know, 6 weeks, or it could take 6 months.
Yeah, I could see that. And it's interesting how what the music seems to be doing there is basically facilitating meditation and mindfulness exercises, right? Which work in their own right and could work without music, but it seems like the music can help create a context or something that they can keep with them to almost condition themselves to relax.
Exactly. Yeah. There's different theories about how this works, but conditioning is one thing, and, you know, other traditions like sound healing would say something like it's the actual vibrations of the music that help slow down your nervous system.
Okay, so there are different theories for why the music helps with relaxation, but it seems like it does. I think that's something very intuitive to most people.
Yeah, most people think that that's kind of what music therapy is. Oh, they say, oh, you're a music therapist. Oh, do you play music to help people relax? That's that's often the first thing that comes to their mind. Yeah. And it is wonderful at that, but that's only one of the many things it can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one question I have that's a little bit of a sidetrack, maybe another window into what music does and when it's therapeutic or not, which is that some people create music instead of consuming it, right? And we sometimes, these musicians will become well known, or they'll get a big following, and they might even become celebrities, and they get in the history books, or we see them on TV. And I feel like a lot of our music icons have sort of troubled lives. And I don't know if it's just that our culture focuses on them, or that there really is something more unstable about the people who do music and make it big, whether it's a classical musician like Beethoven or an Amy Winehouse sort of musician. what's your sense as a musician yourself, as you know, a violinist, and you play many other instruments? What's your sense of how creating music can be stressful, or a certain person that might do that might be unstable? Or do you have a sense that there is some danger of that? Or what would be your explanation for this image I have of the mad musician?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I had a listener ask that a few weeks ago, similar type of question. And I think it makes sense. You know, people want to know, if music is healing, how is it that these musicians are having these drug addictions and terrible lives and things like that? So I think a couple of things. One is, music performers, like anything, like actors or anybody who's on a spotlight on the national stage or international stage, you know, that I think that dynamic in itself just creates a lot of stress. The pressure to keep the status that they've attained, kind of a rat race for selling more records, or, you know, that can become a way to gain self-worth. Or because that becomes your identity if you're some kind of national icon, singer, Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, these types of musicians and performers. It's not really so much about the music, right, for them. It's about getting fans, creating the next hit, and, you know, I don't remember much about Whitney Houston's childhood, but I know that, for instance, Michael Jackson's father used to, had said on BBC radio on an interview, had said that he used to whip all of his children during their rehearsals.
Yikes.
When they were young. So, you know, if you think about that, and abuse connected with success in music, then, you know, as a performer, if that's been your experience and that's been your past, then, you know, you're going to be trying to succeed as a performer out of fear or out of this past kind of negative conditioning, abusive conditioning that you had as a child. So, and I think one of the psychologists that was, a British psychologist that was talking about Michael Jackson had said that, well, you know, based on that information about his father, that probably his success as a performer was tied to him trying to gain self-worth back or overcome feelings of failure that he felt with his father, who was always, you know, critical and very demanding. And so I think, by the time people get to that national spotlight, there's a lot that's happened already in their lives of getting there, a lot of sacrifices. And it just happens to be also a culture where there's, at least in the popular music scene, where there is more drug and addiction and alcohol abuse and things like that.
Yeah, and it does seem like culture is important. If you're like a rock singer, there's a certain hedonistic backstage sort of culture that you're going to get sucked into separately from the music. That might be what drew you to that career, to that music. And that's a little separate from just what the music sounds like or what it makes the audience feel, right?
Right. And I think other traditions, like certainly classical musicians, have to deal with slightly different things. But in some cases, you know, I know many classical musicians, for instance, who went through this rigorous training with very critical teachers and learned this very particular way of playing where they didn't feel like they had much creativity and they felt they had to sort of fit into this very narrow box. And some of them quit playing because the process of learning with kind of not the most supportive teachers was, you know, created some extra baggage for them that they then had to work out later in their life. So, but certainly that could be true for many professions. I think I would like to think that, well, what would happen to these people if they didn't have music, you know? Who knows if they would still be alive?
Huh. Maybe. Yeah. Okay, so that was a sidetrack of, you know, creating music versus consuming it, and has to do with celebrity and culture and who knows what else.
Yeah.
I think we can safely say that that's not an indictment of music or music therapy.
Right.
That there are drug addicted musicians out there or unstable musicians out there. So back to music. Tell me about some of your favorite projects as a therapist or as a community advocate. Any sort of example that you come back to feeling like you really were successful. One that I saw on your website is you were working with children in group homes to tell the story of their traumatic pasts. So this is sort of a community service oriented project. So something like that resonates with you.
Yeah, there's actually one that comes to my mind. When I was working in Denver, I was invited to co-lead a drum circle at the Susan G. Komen Multicultural Breast Cancer Conference. They had an annual conference that was going on several years ago. And that was very powerful. It was a conference, an educational conference for several hundred women from various cultures, many different Asian cultures, Vietnamese, Chinese. There were some groups there from different Native American tribes, different women, African Americans, and some people from Latino cultures. And it was so kind of electric, I think, partly because there were people speaking all these different languages, and there were people from all different generations. There were people who were breast cancer survivors, people who had family members who were going through treatment. And so this drumming and drum circle was really a wonderful way to help people connect in spite of these differences. So my co-therapist and I created a rhythmic chant for each culture in different languages, in using a simple phrase that was very accessible. So like the one that was in Spanish was Viva la Vida. So we created a rhythm to go with that. Another was yin yang, yin yang. So we arranged everybody in a large circle, handed out drums and percussion for each person. And one by one, we led each group in first doing this their chant and then adding the rhythm. And all these parts fit together and created this polyrhythmic drumming kind of celebratory session. And it was such a wonderful metaphor of building community and being able to communicate non-verbally. Well, some of it was chanting, some of it was verbal, but it was more the rhythmic intention of the chant, being able to communicate even though people spoke different languages. And there were some elderly women, for instance, who'd survived breast cancer, who were just smiling, singing, dancing, and just had this amazing energy. And, you know, I think we ended the whole conference that way. And it was really wonderful, just very, very inspiring.
Yeah. And it's something that could easily be passed by as an opportunity. You could easily just have a conference where people just meet and see each other and talk and shake hands and go home. And it's something that at first people might be shy about, but it sounds like once you're in the thick of it, once you're chanting and feeling the rhythm and participating with everyone, you can really feel that energy.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I learned about working with people who are going through life-threatening illnesses is that, you know, it's such a serious process, and treatment and doctors and hospitals, and it can be very draining. And people, one of the things is that people really need, told me, and I witnessed this, that they really need an opportunity to play and just experience joy. And when they're threatened with, you know, possibly their life being much shorter than they expected, having this life-threatening illness, they also realize what are the most important things in life. And they don't want to go through life not enjoying it anymore. And so, you know, it's not just kind of, oh, let's just have fun and bang on some drums a little bit. It really plays a vital and in some ways life-saving role for some of these women, because there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, positive experiences, having support, having, you know, reaching out for support, you know, affects our brain. Our immune system is stronger. And there was a recent study done by, quite a while ago by Barry Bittman, where they did some drumming and actually measured cortisol levels and measured the immune system response based on this drumming, and, you know, had statistically significant results from that of it actually increasing immune system functioning. So there's a lot of factors involved.
Right. Well, I like the example you gave of the Denver Breast Cancer Conference, because there it's another case where the music is not just, you're not just sitting back and listening to something and it's just inducing effects similar to listening to your iPod, but it's serving something grander. And in that case, it was building community and building ties, which is very healthy and restorative in its own right. Just like you can use music to help people meditate and to sort of recondition themselves. And so I guess I hope that some of what we've done this hour is help people not think of music in a vacuum and think of how it can be a gateway to many other things and can be combined with other very transformative processes.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Sangeeta Swami, we're going to close up soon, but I'd love to play out with a song if there's something you think would be appropriate or evocative for you.
Well, there's a number of different songs that I love to listen to. I can share one that's one of my favorites, and that is Holy Now. It's a folk song by Peter Mayer. It's just has a really wonderful message about kind of that everything in life is sacred and spiritual, and you don't have to necessarily go through religion to find that. You know, the images, I think, in that the song are really beautiful and helps remind me of, I think, what's most important in this kind of larger picture, which for me is very healing. And I've also found that to be true for many of the people that I've worked with, that, you know, people need to have a larger picture in order to really be able to heal.
So sort of putting things in perspective.
Yeah, larger meaning of why this is happening. Yeah.
Great. Well, we'll end with Holy Now, but first, for our listeners, we've been speaking with Dr. Sangeeta Swami. She's an award-winning musician, a licensed psychotherapist, an educator, a scholar, and a board-certified music therapist. She's talked about her work with children, teens, and adults, helping them heal through music. Her show at WCOM is The Sound Effect on Mondays at 9 a.m. or at thesoundeffect.wordpress.com. And this was Psych Talk. I'm Jose Dras Lopez, and you can find all our shows at psychtalkradio.com. That's psychtalkradio.com. And we'll end with Holy Now.
When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church, pay attention to the priest. Would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now.